This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my company, Horns of Odin. Now, Horns of Odin is a family-run business, and we sell Norse-inspired products. Particularly, we specialise in handmade, handcrafted drinking horns, which I made myself. But alongside that, we have a huge clothing collection. We sell a bunch of different meads. We've got beers and ales. We've got handmade jewellery, books, artwork. So if you like the sound of any of that, pop over to the website. It's www.hornsofodin.com. If you like anything, pop it in the cart. Use the code HORNS10 at checkout and you're going to get 10% off your entire order. Now that's HORNS10. It's going to get you 10% off your entire order. It's just a little thank you from us for listening to the podcast. The podcast is also brought to you by our website, NordicMythologyPodcast.com. Some of you have already seen that we've got a bunch of different merch on there. We've got some t-shirt designs. Now we've just added a brand new limited edition t-shirt. So there's only going to be 100 of these printed. After that, we're never going to print them again. So just pick one up whilst you can. So the design has been done by last week's guest, Jakob, aka Raven from the North, who was on last week's episode. It's a one-off design. Just pop over to the website, have a look. It's Odin and his two ravens. It's a really beautiful t-shirt. I'm definitely going to get one. I think we've sold probably about 25% of them already. So just pop over to NordicMythologyPodcast.com and have a look and see what you think. Right, let's jump into the show. Hello and welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farron, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin. And I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvig.
Hello, everybody. We are joined this time by Shane Smith, who is a stand-up comedian and also runs a podcast, I see, called Cowboy Boys. Welcome to the show, Shane.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time.
Course.
Yeah, I mean, we've just been having a little chat before the show, and you are, appears to me, a super nerd, which I think is brilliant.
Yes, big nerd. I know more about Lord of the Rings history than most people know about their own country's history.
Sure. There you go.
100%.
There's nothing wrong with that. You were saying that you do some medieval combat, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. I got I did some like Highland game stuff, which got me linked up with people who are more into like historical sports. And then I got into HEMA sword fighting, which is kind of fencing with long swords. And then I was like, swords are stupid. Where do I get an axe?
And then, of course.
And then someone was like, I have a place for you. And then they showed me medieval combat, which is, you know, full armor, anywhere ranging from the 13th to the 15th century, though most people are late 14th, early 15th. And then they were like, you can hit people with a polearm, a sword, an axe. And I was like, this is me right here. So I've been doing that for a little bit, and it's really fun.
So is the aim of that just to knock the person over?
Yeah, so it's so they do it historically. So if you're dueling, sometimes they'll count strikes, like if you're doing long sword, they'll count strikes and things, but often you just duel till one person submits. and so they, you know, knocking them to the ground is usually their time to submit, because you could just clobber them when they're down there. Cause you know, in real life, if you knock a knight down, usually a knight will be accompanied by several lesser armored people, and then they hold him down and stab him to death. Or capture him for ransom.
I feel like we're opening a can of worms here, Matthias. Do you remember when we said that somebody could beat a knight if he was knocked off his horse?
Yeah.
And then somebody got upset in the comments and was like, no, the knight.
Yeah, no, I remember that part. But, you know, there are well-designed knives for that stuff that can, like, go in through the, what do you call that, visor? Is that what it's called in English?
The visor.
Yeah.
So, like, you just stab him right in the eye there or under the arms, you know, it's another soft spot, right?
One of the most famous medieval battles of all time was the Battle of the Golden Spurs, where the Flemish beat all the, they were just like literally a bunch of guys like us. And they had this special weapon, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's just a club with a spike on the end of it. and they beat like a couple thousand French knights. It's called the Battle of the Golden Spurs because after they didn't take any, they didn't ransom the knights, which is normally what happens. So if a knight beats another knight, he like sells him off for a bunch of money. But if a working class person beats a knight, you're in big trouble, buddy. I don't want your money. I want your soul. And so the Flemish, they killed all the French knights and they melted down their spurs and then sold them. So, and they had help from a bunch of Germanic Zweedlanders or whatever they're called, guys with big two-handed swords at Wreck House. And they were, it's trigger warning if you don't like horse damage, but you know, they cut horses' legs off and then the French fall off their horse and then they do German stuff to them, which no one wants that to happen to
you. That's exactly how the Danish army got destroyed too in the Deep Marsh in what is now northern Germany in Holstein. There was a famous battle where that was also what we talked about on that last episode where we got into all of the stuff about knights. Basically just a bunch of peasants with a couple of clubs. They completely obliterated these heavy knights on armor and everything. Most of them, I think, drowned because they managed to like lure them into an area that they could flood. So there you go.
That's how you do it. And that's how the Scottish won. I can't remember what that battle was, but they flooded the marshes. And then when the knights tried to come around, they did Scottish stuff to them, which is also bad. You never want that to happen to you.
No, that's why we built Hadrian's Wall.
Yeah,
we were like, you guys just stay up there. I think you always see in the movies, they kind of pull the knight off or he falls off the horse and then, or maybe the horse falls sometimes, but it gets up and runs away. It's very rarely that it's like, they just cut the legs off the horse. But I imagine that's what you would do if you were in battle, because I know if there was a guy on a horse riding towards me, I really like animals, but unfortunately the horse has got to go if it's me or him.
Yes, that is absolutely the play. You got to take the horse out, which is how the English ended up be like at the very end of armor when that was famous. They were the best at it because they were like, oh well, we'll just not go on the horse. And then you won the Battle of Agincourt that way.
Yeah.
The French attacked the English and the English just weren't on horses. And the French were like, that seems stupid. You guys are just going to stand there. And they were like, come on over and find out.
Those pesky English. We've always got something up our sleeve.
You really do.
So one thing I wanted to ask you before we get into the looks, if we touched on it a little bit before, is obviously you are a heavily tattooed man.
Yes.
You were saying you have some runes and that kind of stuff. And I was just interested in, because we've spoke quite a lot on here about how stuff is misinterpreted or people will try and twist it into white supremacy and all that kind of bullshit. You know, me and Mateus are both covered in Nordic symbols.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you'd face any of that from, especially being a stand-up comedian, it seems to be a very liberal left kind of environment.
Yeah. So I do, I don't get it a lot in stand-up. I think my politics in stand-up are, because I am a more political comic, and I am like a very left, I'm far left. Mm-hmm. Like the Department of Homeland Security has had to speak to me several times and tell me to stop saying I'm going to kill politicians in jokes. Shit. Or whatever. So
now you're gonna get me in trouble, man.
I'm sorry. I got in trouble once for saying I was going to, if Bill Clinton was a pedophile, that I would kill him. And then they came and talked to me, and I was like, seems like I said only if. It seems like, why are you here? If anyway, it doesn't matter. So
it's a conditional statement.
And so I'm not a big fan of establishment. I'm like so close to being like, I'm just gonna be a homesteader. I want to just go out into the wilderness. I want people to live on communes. We should go back to living in small communities. But anyway, that's besides the point. So comics don't usually have these arguments or things to say to me about that. But I will say, when I date, women will approach me and be like, are you a Trump person? Which is kind of code right now in our country for, are you racist? All the time. And they'll be like, you look like it. I'm like, what does that mean? You know, and often it's the, oh, you have tattoos, you have long hair, you seem like they
you're white.
Yeah. No, and I think that it's kind of this weird, like, well, if you have a people would say it here, you have a Viking look to you, and that's Viking like look. Yeah, then that's like dangerous or whatever. And
that's what I was kind of hinting at, is that this whole, like I said, quote unquote Viking look, especially in the USA, seems to be just attached to white supremacy and racism. And it's just so fucking annoying to see.
It is. What's even funnier is that they'll be like, you look like a Viking or whatever, and then that's racism. But like, racism is skinheads, so, which are not, I don't, anyway, so I get that a little bit, and it is annoying. And I'm always quick to kind of tell people off in terms of that conversation, like, you're making all these assumptions about me, you know, and I don't think. So that's always an issue, but not in comedy, but definitely in life. I think I do come up against some people being weird at times. So
that, I think that's just face tattoos, hand tattoos, neck tattoos in general.
In general, yeah.
Obviously, you have quite a popular stand-up bit on, is it face tattoos ruin your life?
Yeah. That's the, and you know, people don't realize how ironic it is, because I'm like saying, oh, tattoos will ruin your life or whatever, but I'm like on stage living my dream, speaking to them, doing well, and then they're like, yeah, they did ruin your life. It's like, you came here to see me. What are you talking about?
You're on the Nordic Mythology podcast. What the fuck do they mean?
Exactly.
It doesn't get any higher.
We've made it, boys.
so we said we were going to look at Loki with this episode, take a deep dive into who he is. And that, like I said, that seemed like a really fitting subject matter, you know, with you being a stand-up comedian, Loki being the trickster. And I feel like Loki would kind of look like you if he really existed, especially modern day, that kind of heavy leather tattooed, long hair, tattoos on the face.
I think Loki has a lot of, I like Loki a lot because also he's like the black sheep of his family. His father's a giant, yes, or his mother. And so he's kind of like got this weird, you know, maybe what's going on with his parentage. Does he even belong in the family? And is he an embarrassment? And he's kind of like androgynous in some tellings of his thing. Sometimes he's a woman, sometimes he's a man, which is also something I'm like, I do drag and like am a weirdo, and I like to be a man in a dress. And if you don't like it, I'll fight you. Like, that feels good to me. You know, I enjoy that. I just enjoy like getting to do whatever I want whenever I want. And so Loki speaks to me in that way.
Absolutely. That sounds pretty much spot on, you know, somebody who just wants to does what they want to do and fuck everyone else, which is, I think, is a brilliant way to be.
Yeah.
So Matthias, let's start with Loki as at the beginning, where he comes from, who he is, I guess, who his parents are. Obviously, I think everybody knows Loki from the Marvel movies would always kind of be like, oh, well, he's Odin's son and Thor's brother.
Yeah, so we do have that. I think it's like in like, so he's in Snorri's Edda. From 1220, he's mentioned as like Loki Lurveyason. And Lurve is presumably this goddess, but we don't really know anything about her. We just know that he is like the only one is referred to as the son of a female, too, which is also actually quite interesting when you like start digging into some of the, you know, coding of like gender in the myths. And Farbeauty is supposed to be his father, but we don't know anything. And he's supposed to be a giant again. There's so little information on it. What really is told about Loki in the mythology, in sort of like Snorri's very Christian perspective of it, is that he's like Judas or the devil, basically some kind of like trickster figure, but malignant trickster figure to the gods, right? And this is because like Snorri, he's sitting there with this nice 13th century Christian perspective on things. He basically favors sort of like an idea. He's not really good at, you know, sticking to his guns all the time. So he tries to fashion like his version of the pantheon of the Nordic gods with like Odin as sort of like a weird warrior inversion of Christ. And then we have the 12 disciples and Loki as a Judas. But sometimes he fucks up too. And like, oh yeah, there's also actually this god. And there's also kind of like that god. And, you know, those kinds of things. So it goes a little back and forth in his representations of it. But the whole deal is that he very much has like that perspective on it and tries to represent the mythology as sort of like watered down, really, really bizarre version of the story of Christ. So that's how a lot of Loki is actually like fashioned. That's where a lot of our the ideas of like what he actually is come from. But this is all based off of a foundation of a bunch of really interesting like trickster stories, where Loki is probably acting more like some Viking would initially have thought of him back before everybody converted to Christianity. So you have, for instance, the story where the story about Thjazi, the giant that steals Idun and her golden apples, which again, according to Snorri Sturluson, are the ones that keep the gods young. And then they start getting old, and they're like wondering what's going on. And they find out eventually that it's because Loki had made a deal with this giant named Thjazi that basically he wouldn't kill him if he helped him kidnap Idun. and then that played out, and then they're like, well, now you got to bring her back. And so he goes and does that, but the end result is that the gods have to kill Thjazi, and that pisses off his daughter Skadi, who then shows up dressed in armor and everything, and she's like, well, we need Wergild here. You guys got to pay up here. And then they agree that she gets to marry one of the gods. And also Loki has to make her laugh. Now, the way that he makes her laugh, the marriage is boring, but the way that he makes her laugh, that's interesting, because he ties a string to the beard of a goat. And then he ties the other end of that string to his own balls. And
got me immediately, dude. He got it so fast.
That's, I mean,
this is professional.
Right?
That can be your next bit on stage. Just bring out a little Billy Goat.
This one's a classic throwback.
one from the ages.
So one of the things that interests me about like the Nordic pantheology and stuff is that it has like a pseudo Germanic equivalent before like the Great Migration down to like the Greece and Rome and everything. And does Loki have a Germanic proto counterpart that we know of?
So there is a one runic inscription from Bavaria from, I think it's the 5th century, so 400 and something, that mentions not Loki as such, but it says, the inscription mentions Loka Thore. So there's something that suggests some kind of mixing of Thor and Loki, actually, which also makes a lot of sense because those two quite often in the stories go together, right? Like, Thor is out bumbling around somewhere in his wagon, and he has Loki with him. That's a pretty standard theme. And if we sort of dig into structures that seem similar, there are elements of the stories about Loki that pop up elsewhere in other cultures, probably disseminated through that, you know, deep historical layer of Indo-European connections of various kinds. So we have Prometheus in Greek-Roman mythology that in many ways seemed very similar to Loki. He's also a trickster, of course. He steals fire. We have, what is his name? Sirton, which is a folk hero in the Caucasian Mountains in, I think it's Ossetian folklore, that actually has a lot of elements that are very similar to the stories about Loki in Scandinavia. So this all, and then you can go to the Vedic material in northern India and also find similarities between Loki and certain characters in the myths there. So he's definitely an old deity in some capacity. And then he's like taken on different shapes and forms as culture and history has developed. And then the last version of that is basically like Snorri's very like demonized figure.
I find it so interesting that there's so many in mythology, there's so many themes that run through ancient culture. And then as soon as we get to the new wave of the sort of like Abrahamic religions, they don't have the equivalent for a lot of them. And so when they try to like shoehorn the idea of them into their own ideas, they're like, oh, Loki's Judas. And it's like, oh, dude, how much cooler would it have been if Jesus had a Loki hanging out? There was no funny apostles. What the hell? they didn't have one funny guy.
I mean, that just sums up Christianity for me.
Yeah.
There were no funny apostles.
There's no funny. Those guys were not funny. It was doom and gloom the whole way through.
That's true. There's something about that.
Spanish Inquisition could never have happened maybe if there was just one funny apostle. Just one of them just made everyone laugh.
Hey, speaking of the Spanish Inquisition, I just have to put something out there, especially because you're British. The Spanish Inquisition was literally the most chill Inquisition of all the Inquisitions in medieval Europe and early modern Europe. Did you actually know that?
No, but I'm sure you're going to tell me that we did worse things.
I will, absolutely. That's always the case. But this is so funny, right? Because they have like this reputation of being like really, really scary and always like looking for witches and heresy and all that stuff. But the Spanish Inquisition, when they got these like reports of like, oh, there's witchcraft going on over here. In most cases, they were like, eh, and then they move on. Whereas like go to Germany and it's all like, oh, there's a witch, burn them all.
Well, you know, we have a checkered past.
That's a good way to put it.
I think that's the easiest way to put it.
The French, they were also pretty bad with you know, hunting witches and all that stuff.
For sure. So if we get back to Loki, obviously people say that he's Thor's brother. How is that accurate? Is there anything to support that? Or is that literally just from something from Marvel that's kind of dragged on and because I think most people now would just assume that that's fact.
Yeah, that's Marvel. We don't have any sources on that. He's the blood brother of Odin, according to one story, a poem called Lokasenna, which basically means Loki's quarrel, where he like kicks the door in at a party. The gods are having a party. He kicks the door in, and he then starts like calling everybody names, pretty much. that's all it is.
Is that the story where is he in the party, then gets kicked out, but then comes back and just tells everyone a little piece of his mind?
Actually, the fact that he's in the party and then gets kicked out, that might be a misunderstanding on behalf of the person who originally wrote the story down. Because we have a poem that begins with Loki wanting to go in to a party and then start talking shit to everybody. That's really what he's saying. And then there's this doorman or whatever he is. He's like, I don't think you should do that, bro. He's like, yeah, I'm going to do it anyway. And then he does that. But there's also a little prose introduction
that is younger than the poem that was written by the guy who wrote down the text. And that's the one that tells us that he got kicked out first. It's like the poem begins with him just, you know, like kicking in the door. So the guy who actually wrote it down originally in 1270, approximately, he probably misunderstood that or felt like he needed to add a little bit more to the story to make it interesting or something like that. And so that's why there's that little discrepancy there. But yeah, the end of it all is that he goes in and then he really just starts shit talking. And it's he's like, he comes in and he's like, hey, is anybody gonna like give me some beer or something? And people are like, not that guy. Brahi, the god of poetry, he's like, dude, fuck off. And Loki's like, no. Odin, we're like blood brothers. Like, you said you wouldn't drink beer without me. That's literally what he says.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't even drink beer without him.
Exactly. So Odin is like, yeah, okay, fine. Vida, can you move? So then Loki can sit there. And Loki is like, thanks. And then he gets a cup and then he's like, hey, cheers, everybody. Except that motherfucker Brahi over there. Fuck you. And he goes on from there.
I mean, what an interesting character to be willing to just go in and talk shit to all the gods. I feel like he's almost just an accumulation of what everybody wants to do or say, put into one character. You know, things that they can't really do in everyday life, they're just all built into this one character who's just, sounds like a really awesome guy, to be honest.
I dig him. I don't know how I want to word this. Is there like the possibility of, because there's so many relationships between like where Thor and Loki are just always together and everyone's like, oh, they're brothers, that are similar to like in the Odyssey, like Achilles and Patroclus, everyone's like, they're cousins. But then if you read actual translations, they're like, oh, they bang all the time. Like Achilles is in love with Patroclus and they just kill people together. And you're like, oh, that sounds like a pretty healthy relationship, actually. But like, you know, our modern sensibilities are like, oh, well, you can't just have sex with your best friend that you kill people with and then also have a wife or whatever. That doesn't register. So we're just going to make him his cousin. Like, there's none of that could be going on with Loki and Thor, like these relationships that we don't really understand.
There's nothing in the language that I've noted, at least, that really indicates that. What we usually get is sort of like just a statement that's like, oh, Thor was on a journey to Utgardr, for instance. That's the story of Utgardr Loki, and Loki was with him. So there's nothing that really indicates any sort of like sexual or romantic relation. And it also, what we're seeing generally in the literature from that time period, from medieval Iceland, is that they're incredibly homophobic, actually.
Interesting.
It's really interesting because there's something to be said for a male surplus too in medieval Iceland. There's 2/3 of the population presumably was male, and that's quite a gender imbalance. This seems to have been like from the already from the time where Iceland gets settled. So Iceland seems to have a lot more concerns when it comes to what you could call a deviant or a non-conforming sexuality in different ways. And that's what they called to be Arkr, or you are Erki. And that was the worst accusation you could come with, which also actually happens in that poem, Loki's Quarrel, where Loki and Odin end up accusing each other of being Arkr, which is also quite interesting. He's like, hey, blood brother, you're Arkr. It's like, yeah, so are you, man.
So interesting.
What's going on there, guys? Like if anybody had like a romantic relationship, I'd bank on Loki and Odin. On the other hand,
interesting. All right. So and you don't think that was a Christianization of people in Iceland being sort or like something influenced by Christianization as they're sort of like being weird about just like what Christianity thinks are non-traditional relationships.
Yeah, that is a possibility. I mean, all of this literature is written down after the conversion to Christianity. So there is something to be said for that. But we do see it actually in sources that seem to be that are assumed to be before the conversion. For instance, the Danish king Harald Bluetooth, in certain slander poetry about him, is said to have had sexual relations with his sheriff. Which would be that like typical accusation that that is there to basically emasculate him, to dethrone him in general. One of the popular stories about how he died, there are multiple, but one of the popular ones is that he died by getting shot through the ass with an arrow that then came out of his mouth.
Imagine that.
There are some hardcore people who really hated that guy for some reason.
I mean, that's a good shot.
Yeah.
Because he has to either be bent over, ready for the arrow, or they're underneath him when they shoot the arrow.
So the story is that he was going to the bathroom. So he was bent over.
Oh, okay. Someone was in down in the hole.
No, this was out in the woods. He was out in the woods, so he had to do it natural style, so to speak. And then I think it was Palnatoki. He was like hiding in the bushes, and then whoosh, with an arrow.
That's a good shot. That's a bullseye.
That's the whole point, isn't it? That mm-hmm. it's a bullseye.
Yeah.
am I right in thinking that there was a difference between in homosexual acts? One being the giver and one being the taker, and that was a huge difference in how they perceived it and how it was accepted. I know when I was reading Viking Britain, he made a point of that, and how if you were to be the taker, quote unquote, or the bottom, then that was that was bad, that was emasculating you, it was someone was taking your masculinity. Whereas if you were the top, it was almost a power move, like you were. You were the powerful one and you were emasculating somebody else, and you were kind of not, I don't know whether it was a good thing, but definitely a very different thing to being on the receiving end.
Yeah, there's something about that, right? There's the person who's receiving is the one who is considered effeminate, whereas the person who's given, who's considered the active part, so to speak, he's the masculine one, and he maintains his masculinity and reinforces it by doing that act. And again, this seems to there's so much to be said for this in context of early Icelandic society, because it's just like a couple of weeks ago that I published an article on aggressive masculinity in early Iceland as a function of experiences with the environment. So basically what you see is a bunch of migrants that go to a place that is generally harder to farm and harder to live in than the places they come from. So that means that resources are scarcer. And that means then that there's harder competition for land, for instance. So all the ways in which you can demonstrate that you're a dominant male are the ones that will get you more land, provide better security, and all of these things. Because you never know when your neighbor is going to try to raid you. If they're sitting over there starving, if they don't have any women, which is something that they actually had to make laws against, stealing each other's women, like one village going to take the other village's women, that kind of stuff that actually happened in medieval Iceland. So yeah, that was a real problem, that there were too many men, and these men were trying to dominate each other in all the ways in which they could. And they had a land taking ritual, which is basically you have a totem pole already there. The phallic element is introduced, right? That's how the story goes in the saga literature. You bring a totem pole of some kind with the carved image of Thor or something in it. And then you sail to Iceland, and then you take that log of wood, and then you're like, well, I shall take land wherever this log lands. And then you throw it overboard, and then you let it, you know, sail to shore on its own, so to speak. And then you take land where you find it.
This I wonder is, how many people just like put it back on the ship and put it somewhere else after. kind of like when you're playing golf and your ball goes somewhere you don't want to just kick it out, like kick it onto the green a little bit. Like, they must have, surely. Like, I don't want this fucking bit of land here.
So the funny thing about this is that it seems like it's those who have tried to recreate it, because of course Icelanders have tried, like in modern times, to historically recreate this. And they've like noted that they tend to just float out to sea instead. So it's symbolic. It's a symbolic statement, right? Because the land is considered feminine in Nordic mythology, right? The goddess of the earth is goddess. And so you have a phallic object that's basically there to penetrate that female land. That's the whole deal here. And they have a whole ritual for it. That ritual is different when you're a female taking land in Iceland. Then you have to drag a cow around the piece of land that you take. Whereas the guy takes literally like a physical representation of his dick. And then he digs a hole and then he puts it in there and he's like, my land, guys, my land.
Isn't that why Icelanders get so strong? They're just like had to get the biggest piece of wood humanly possible. Probably. It's just learning how to deadlift 800 pounds so you can carry your fake dick around. This is me right here. What are you? Oh, yours is, 6 feet? I mean, that's fine, but I've got 9, so.
Exactly. And that's the whole deal, right? So they're standing there. They're standing there on each their little piece of land with this like, phallus sticking out of it, being like, this is mine, right? Yeah, you stay over there.
I mean, something's never changed, do they? Because that is, it's almost so modern as well, just that kind of that flex of, I've got the biggest totem pole, I'm the best.
Truly, nothing has changed since ancient times. I saw the funniest, someone found a Roman officer's sword, and in the bottom of the hilt, it was carved into a dick, and it was a gift. It was a gift from another officer to him. He had commissioned a sword for him, but then the sword had a dick handle. And basically the inscription was like, have fun with your dick sword, dick. And that was it. And then, so he sent his friend like a sword with a dick on it just to troll his buddy. And he took it to war with him.
It's actually
amazing.
Dicks are one of the most common objects that we find in Roman archaeology in general. there were so many of them everywhere. Roman soldiers used to wear necklaces with little penis pendants on them as protection, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you can't leave a man alone with a pen and a paper, like a pen and a piece of paper, for more than 10 minutes without a dick being drawn. It's impossible. Because that's the first thing I draw. And it just happens. Matthias, one final question on this that I want to ask. So, like I say, in Viking Britain, when I was reading it, he mentions how in some cases, when Vikings came to maybe like Lindisfarne or some of the monasteries, that they would, I don't know how to phrase it, but sodomize the monks as a power move. Is that accurate? Did that happen? Because I feel like we're going to upset a lot of Viking bros if you say yes. Like, there's going to be a lot of like macho Viking men that's like upset.
I don't know if there's any sources that says that. Like, who's our source on Lindisfarne? That's Alcoin, right?
I don't know if it was just Lindisfarne. I just remember it being in Viking Britain.
It's a reasonable theory to suggest, based off of all the stuff that we've just talked about, because, I mean, it's the same literature that's basically informing us on what kind of culture and attitudes these people would have when they're, you know, coming from, like, say, Norway or Denmark or Sweden. Like, they're moving out into that world, and they they probably would if that was a meaningful way of demonstrating your power. Yeah, then they probably would. But when you think about it, it seems, you know, right there in the middle of the killing, I was like, I'm just gonna make a statement here. Like,
it seems a bit.
I'm gonna take a quick break. Pause, everyone. I have a thing to take care of. No one ask about it. I'll be in here. That does sound a little wild.
Yes, for sure.
It's also interesting to me that I think that that would also be like the people who are afraid being like, "Don't, the Vikings will get you. Like, don't let them near you." You know, that's like a fear thing, because that's what, you know, during World War II, lot like Japan said the Marines would do that if they captured you. There were like other, you know, that's like a fear mongering thing that a lot of armies say about other armies. One of the reasons everyone's scared of the Sacred Band of Thebes, because they were all lovers and they were just like, they'll get you. Like, you cannot let them beat you because they will get you. And then it's also interesting how they talk about everyone in ancient times talks about gay relationships, and they sort of seem to be like obsessed with fucking people in the ass. But that's like not how gay relationships work. There's lots of gay couples that just never do that. Like, just the same way you have a straight relationship and maybe you don't put your penis in your wife or girlfriend's bum. That also happens that way. So
yeah,
it's just interesting to me that that's like the line. And it does seem like if you read anything ancient, there's like lots of, we call them Boston wives here in the United States, like, where it's just like two chicks that live together and like, but that's fine. You know what I mean? And so there's lots of like those types of relationships between men in tons of ancient texts. Like, oh, they were best friends. They were always together till they died. Super weird, right? Didn't seem like he cared about his wife much. But like, as soon as you start talking about a butt stuff, people get crazy. But that's like not how homosexual relationships work. So it's interesting that in medieval times, that's like the main focus of homosexuality. It's like just busting cheeks. They were obsessed with busting cheeks, dude. It's like not how it works.
Yeah, so I can give you some input on some of this. If we compare with the witchcraft trials in the 1600s in Scandinavia, we have a lot of witchcraft trials, like witchcraft crazes and all that stuff. But for all the people who are being accused of witchcraft and go through trials and all that stuff, there are so many more cases of weird sexual behavior. Like in Norway, I believe it's incest. In Sweden, it's bestiality. You know, those kinds of trials, they take up far more like court time than the witchcraft trials. In Denmark, it's like drunken brawls, killing people in drunken brawls, as far as I remember. I can't remember.
The Danes, man. They're just, like, can't psychos. Be stopped. They can't be stopped.
But it just tells you a little bit about like how, like what we sometimes tend to focus on. It also tells you a bit about what other cultural modes are happening, like what is going on here. And I mean, that banging your cow or something like that, that does sound like a very lonely farmer.
Yeah. Do witchcraft, man. Do something else.
Do witchcraft.
Yeah, you should have been doing witchcraft, I feel like.
The whole point is, though, that you know, like it seems like humans do so many different things when it comes to sex and sexuality, right? And depending on the framework of society, some of it is considered acceptable, some of it is not, and so on. Like, you know, speaking of the Danes, let me just throw my own people under the bus here. It's only about 3 years ago we outlawed bestiality in Denmark. We used to have Norwegian sex tourists coming to farms in northern Denmark. So just keep that in mind.
Okay. Yeah,
so, there we go.
Yeah, but this is like a modern country, right? That was just like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, we don't care about that. Up until somebody's like, we should care about that, yeah. Right? So that's how attitudes can also change.
That, I would say that's a good point, that, you know, people judge the past and history on what they did, but it was just, it, what was acceptable then is not acceptable now, but that doesn't mean you can just dismiss it or get rid of it. You can't change it. You just learn about it and things are different now. So what we accept sexually isn't the same as what maybe they accepted and what they were used to.
Yeah. And see, this is also something that comes in like waves and, you know, changes and goes back and forth in different ways, right? And in some periods, you'll have, like, for instance, certain times in the medieval period, like this, like, laser focus on are these two dudes having sex with one another. And in other time periods, there will be like, I don't care if they are, right? And go back and forth like that. And I mean, you could say a lot of things about, for instance, the changing attitudes to women in the late 1400s and through the 1500s in Europe in general, compared to just a couple of centuries before, where, you know, the interesting case is that I believe the law on premarital sex in my part of Denmark, Jutland, in 1240s is basically a woman who has premarital sex. Yes, if she gets pregnant, then the dudes from her family have the right to go to the guy who got her pregnant and force him to marry her. That's it. That's all the law stipulates. It's concerned with who's going to take care of the kid. It's not concerned with whether or not she had sex, right? That comes later. And then all of a sudden, there's like death penalties a couple of centuries later for that kind of stuff, right? So that tells you a lot about a changing attitude to sex right there.
So interesting. It's it oscillates. When I read about ancient times, sometimes I'm like, they are more progressive than we are right now. Like, what? And then it oscillates back to crazy, and then it comes back to and it like kind of moves and ebbs and flows.
I feel like usually when Christianity gets involved, that's when it takes a downward dive.
I didn't want to say it, but you're correct.
You can say it.
Well, this is where I will have to modify our perspectives a little bit here, because, you know, in northern Italy in the 1400s, you will find brothels attached to monasteries, right? The whole idea of celibacy, for instance, is also quite late when it comes to, you know, clergy and all that stuff. It comes like, go back to the year 1000, you can't expect any of them to be celibate.
Yeah, weren't they more like rock stars? They were like because I guess rock stars didn't exist then. The clergy were, you know, the man about town. They were the one that everybody was interested in. They were the rock star, the hero of the village.
And that's the thing too. This changes depending on which region we're in. In some places, you will see very fervent, pious celibacy or some shit like that. And in other places, you, like in Iceland, for instance, you'll have bishops who's like, well, I will just like put my bishopric in the will to my son and such things, right? Like that's official legal business right there. Nobody like bats an eye at it. Like, it's like, yeah, okay, the bishop has a kid over here and a kid over there and so on, right? So that's another thing to take into consideration, that these attitudes also change in so many different ways, and also depending on which region we're in. Modern conceptions of all of this stuff, like, you know, it's so interesting to hear when people are like, oh yeah, we should go back to the old days. And it's like, what old days are you fucking talking about, dude?
There's a lot of old days.
Yeah.
There's a lot of
it. Be specific, because you could be asking for something you do not want.
Exactly.
When people say that, I think they mean the old days that are going to support what I'm saying in this moment.
That's
what they mean.
And often not even right.
No.
That's another thing, right? It's like usually like one element of that old day that they want to go back to. And that's again something, you know, as soon as you start digging into that old day, say like, oh yeah, let's go back to what it was like back in the 1950s. And then you start realizing, hey, wait a minute, 1950s actually spawned some pretty funky shit. Like, yeah. A lot of funky stuff happened in the 1950s, and that's not what you're looking for, my friend.
We have a good time right now. I think there's no better time to be alive. To pull it back to Loki before we get even further off topic, I guess. So,
let's link it back. On topic. We're trolling people right now.
It's true. The spirit of Loki is here. We have no idea where we are right now.
That's it. Exactly. I think the most obvious place to link it back to is Loki getting pregnant with Sleipnir. Obviously, he transforms into a female. I was going to say a female mare then, but a mare. And he's mounted by a stallion, becomes pregnant, and gives birth to an eight-legged horse. Now, what's more fabulous than that, to be fair?
Sounds pretty legit.
It's not gay if you're a lady horse. That's kind of the rule, so.
Yeah.
he found the loophole. Odin's calling him gay, and he's like, but I was a lady horse, so I don't really know what you're saying.
That's a good point.
how legit of a story is that, or is that possible? Like, it's slander almost against Loki, or is it just
this is where it gets interesting, because you know, it's Snorri Sturluson put it in his Edda to make all of these gods, and especially Loki, seem just way more freaky than he needed to be and do, or they needed to be. Probably. Could it be a real, legitimate pre-Christian story? Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it can be used by Snorri Sturluson to frame all of this in some negative or deviant way or something like that, and still also be a legitimate story that actually was something that was told in pre-Christian times. And I find that story quite fascinating, to be honest, because the main purpose here is actually not so much to tell a story about how Sleipnir is born. The main purpose is to tell a story about how the wall around Ásgarður is imperfect. So that's what the story is about. We have the gods, they hire a person basically to build this wall, and then it's like a matter of self-sabotage, because this person turns out to be a giant that wants, I think it's Freya and the sun and the moon. And it was apparently Loki who promised him that if he could finish it on time. No, Loki was the one who sort of like counseled the other gods to make that deal with him, right? And then the bastards like blame Loki for it afterwards, right? Because he's just about to finish. The gods are like, shit, he's just about to finish. And well, who came up with this stupid idea anyway? It was Loki. It's like, nah, not really, guys. You were in on it to begin with. But then next level is then, well, Loki has to like figure out, what do I do? And that's when beautiful horse lady shows up and frolics with the master builder's horse all night, so that he misses a portion of the wall. And it's not finished at the time. So that's that. What it really is telling us, this story, is that, well, the wall around the home of the gods is imperfect. It's you know, you can breach it. That's really what Snorri is interested in telling us. And then this deal with the horse and all that stuff, that's a side story to that.
So Floki took one for the team, so the gods didn't have to make good on their promise.
There you go.
So, all right, guys, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fuck this horse. I'm going to do it for you. I want you to know that you owe me big time on this one. You gotta, like,
yeah.
That's a friend. That's the guy.
Yeah. I mean, why are they so mad at him?
There's only... Damn.
So, Matthias, why eight legs? Do we know that?
I mean, again, so the idea is that we have a supernatural relationship here, right? It's basically a god who's half not God or whatever. Like that these, when they start talking about the giants, right? They in different stories they talk about them as monsters, right? They sometimes they have six heads or three heads or some other weird feature. And Loki doesn't really have a normal kid at any point, right? He's got like the world serpent and the giant wolf and hell.
Yeah, the devil.
Yeah. so it would make sense, right? It makes sense that he'd also like engender a 8-legged horse. That's just not, you know, as bad as the other ones because there wasn't another, you know, like freaky giant involved in it. In this case, a giant's horse, and that's okay, apparently. So that only gives you 8 legs. Now, the 8-legged horse is a feature that we see on picture stones from the Viking Age. Like, so 400 years before Snorri wrote down this story, there is an 8-legged horse that's depicted on picture stones from Gotland in Sweden.
What if it's just a really bad drawing of two horses running next to each other?
There's one thing that they could draw, it was horses. And they do it multiple times. It shows up on several stones. So there's something to be said for this being a real idea that there was an 8-legged horse. Now, whether or not that was Odin's horse, that's another question. Because the guy who's writing it, in some of those pictures, could be a warrior who is, you know, coming to Valhöll, or some have also theorized he could be the god Freyr, because it does look like, going back to the penis theme, it does look like he has an erect penis on that picture. So there's like a lot of theories, but the 8-legged horse did exist in their imaginary universe. And that tells us then that there's something to this story that's probably, you know, quite ancient.
It's almost like somebody was sat around and they're like, you know, horses are really, really good. We really appreciate horses. They do a lot for us. And they're like, well, what's better than a horse?
One with twice
as many legs. Yeah. It's going to run twice as fast, going to pull twice as much.
That's true. And that's so... I mean, what it probably really signifies is that this horse is capable of taking you between worlds. Because if there's anything you can say about those pictures that we see on those stones, it is that it does look like it's a horse that transports people between worlds. It very much looks like somebody has entered another world on those pictures. So that's also what basically is the idea of Odin himself, right? He moves up and down in the cosmos, right? He comes from above to the human world, to the underworld, and back up again. And that's his function. And having a supernatural, really fast-running 8-legged horse for that is useful.
Do they depict gods riding 4-legged horses very often?
Well, see, that's the thing. We can't really tell, because we can't tell if any of those depictions of just some male figure, for instance, on a horse, if that's a god or not. Sometimes it looks like there is a plate from a bronze plate that was attached on a helmet that depicts a little guy with a warrior outfit and a helmet, by the way, a warrior helmet that has like a raven head on it. And he has two ravens with him. And there's also a snake, and he's riding a regular horse. And, you know, you could theorize that there was a depiction of Odin if you wanted to, but you could also say it's an Odinic warrior with the two ravens. There's a lot of ways we can go with those interpretations, so to speak.
Is there any credence to the idea that Valkyries ride flying horses, or is that like a modern thing?
That's a modern thing. So it doesn't really, there isn't a lot of sort of like descriptions of the Valkyries on horses and that are, you know, riding in the sky and all that stuff.
Huh.
The Valkyries tend to be more depicted as just humans. But it's very obvious that, that the idea that Valkyries existed and that they were some kind of spirits, probably like goddesses of fate or something like that, that's definitely present. That's that's something that's actually very consistent. I believe you could probably trace it back to around the first centuries CE, and it's very consistent all the way into the 13, 1400s. There's like a runic inscription in Norway from 1380 something that mentions Valkyries. So that's pretty badass. That's really like a stable idea that has been present throughout that time.
Interesting.
Mateus, do we know why his kids are so fucked up? Like, because he, I feel like, is there a reason? Because he has four children, and there isn't. I mean, there's one questionable human amongst them, I guess. The other three are monsters, which is, I think it's, well, two of them are monsters. One of them is an eight-legged horse, as we just said. So is the problem on Loki's side, or is it his partner's side? I mean, I don't want to blame anyone. I want to shame.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because what it really comes down to is Snorri's shitty attitude. That's what it all boils down to. If you ask me, these representations of Loki and the children and all that stuff, I think Snorri just made that stuff up. So listen to this. This is when Snorri introduces Loki. He goes, "That one is also reckoned among the Aesir, whom some call the Aesir's calumniator and originator of disease, and the disgrace of all gods and men, and blah, blah, blah." He's like, keeps weaving, like, fuck this guy, is basically what he keeps saying, right? And that's really his attitude. And that's also probably the attitude that people had in, like, late pagan era, early Christian era. Loki is the guy we blame for everything. But the idea that he's like the father of these three more or less demonic figures, that's very much promoted by Snorri. I don't think that he actually was originally. Maybe father of the Fenrir wolf. That might be true. But the Midgard serpent, you know, the Midgard serpent is a whole other can of worms when it comes to, like, is it actually the thing that Snorri says it is, and all of that stuff. There's something to suggest, for instance, that in the wording in the prophecy of the Seeress, the source poem to the idea that there is a Midgard serpent out there, there's something that kind of suggests that when it shows up in battles, Thor in Ragnarok, that it might actually be the wolf and not the serpent itself, and so on. So there's something entirely different going on there. There is, of course, the story, the very old and very original story about Thor fishing for the Midgard serpent. That one, we have that depicted on picture stones from, like, I think the earliest one is from the 700s, and this also falls in line with a narrative pattern that we know from multiple cultures, and the idea of a celestial god that battles some kind of primordial serpent from the ocean or other kind of monster, right? That's very standard, and that's an old story. But that is a story that has been present in Scandinavia long before Christianity shows up and long before Snorri Sturluson writes anything. But whether or not that's actually the same, as the cranky stuff that's not starts producing, that's another matter. He seems to be mixing a lot of concepts and mixing a lot of stories together, and then creating this image of this comic book image of a giant serpent that encircles the sea. Like, come on. Like, who's going to believe that? So that's, there's something to be said for these children of Loki, perhaps not actually being his children at all, but just something that is ascribed to him because Snorri really hates this guy, basically.
I feel like everything negative gets attached to him. And I guess we have to speak about Ragnarok and the events that begin Ragnarok, I guess, with Loki saying about the chain of events that caused the death of Baldur. How accurate that is? That is that something that happens? Is that Snorri being quote unquote a cranky little bitch?
Before we do that, let's just take one story that we otherwise know about Loki that might actually be quite old. That's the story about how Loki is responsible for creating Thor's hammer and Odin's spear and like all of these cool things that the gods have, Sif's golden hair. This one, basically, Loki is having fun cutting Sif's hair while she's asleep. That pisses Thor off, of course, because all of a sudden she's bald. And then he's like, well, you got to get her some new hair. And then Loki is like, well, let me go to the dwarves and make them make golden hair for her. And he goes to the dwarves. And then, you know, he gets himself into this weird bet where he's like, I bet you can't make really cool stuff. And you know what? I'll put my head on the line for that. And the dwarves are like, okay, well, we would very much like to kill you. So yes, let's do that. And then these two dwarves, they make all of these things, and Loki tries to sabotage it in the guise of a fly. And he like bites them and in the eye and stuff like that. And ultimately all of these things were made, but Thor's hammer, the shaft on Thor's hammer is a little short. And that's what basically saves Loki, because Odin rules that since they didn't create a perfect hammer, then they don't get to kill him, but they do get to sew his mouth together using string. So that's what they do instead. And this little bit about having his mouth sewn together, it actually looks like that's a original story that Vikings would have told each other back in the 800s. Because from the Danish area, from around 800, there's a stone that was used to protect the bellows in a smithy that has been found. And it has a little hole in the bottom, and that's where you put the mouthpiece of the bellows in so that you can blow. And then the stone stands there in front of the heat, the fire, so that the bellow doesn't catch fire, basically. And on that front that faces the fire is a male head with a nice twirly mustache, by the way, who's had his mouth sewn together. So, like, we have the connection here. We have the smithy and Loki being involved in the smithy stuff in that story, right? Getting his mouth sewn together, and that picture of that person who's had his mouth sewn together. So that's a very trickster-like story, too. Because mm-hmm. what we have here is a figure who is basically responsible through like a curious turn of events, shit he starts himself, for then creating various useful objects that are very important cultural objects, like a spear, like a hammer, like a boat, that's also involved in that. And that seems to be his original role. And that's usually the trickster role, right? The trickster in most mythologies, cultures, shows up, screws up, and then some positive stuff comes out of that screw up, right? That's usually how it goes. Or steals, transgresses some rule of some kind. That would be Prometheus. He steals the fire from the gods. And so that's his original role. And that seems to then sort of like slowly gravitate towards a cosmic role as well, where he becomes some kind of like cosmic regulator. And that's where the death of Baldur shows up. The story of the death of Baldur, we can trace back to at least the 400s. It's probably older. The story of, you know, brother killings, for instance, is also pretty old in European cultures and has had like a mythological context for, you know, millennia. Just think about the founding of Rome, Romulus and Remus, right? That's, again, that's also brothers and all that stuff, with wolves too. So that's a complex in and of itself. Loki is responsible for killing Baldur, and this scene of Loki and Hörður, Baldur's brother, shooting off an arrow made off of some kind of branch that kills Baldur, that's depicted on golden medallions from the 400 or 500s in Northern Europe. I think one of them is from Sweden. So the motif is old, and it was definitely there before Christianity showed up and all that stuff. Of course, we don't have names attached to these figures. It's not like anybody wrote, oh, this is Loki on it, on these medallions. But we can see that that story, I mean, is replicated by Snorri in 1220. So the story has existed for that long in one way or another, in some kind of form. And then it gets attached to Ragnarok, because what is the thing that will cause Ragnarok? Well, that is brother killings. When you violate the bonds of kinship, it says, that's when the world falls apart. And that fits perfectly with the type of society you have in late Viking Age Scandinavia, where everything is built off of like feuding, right? If somebody kills somebody, their family has the right to avenge that death or demand compensation in one way or another. Now, when you have that kind of legal system, then you also have a downward spiral of just feuding. And that's something that, you know, has been seen in multiple contexts in Europe. Also find it in Northern Italy in different contexts. I mean, Romeo and Juliet is one of them. And in Scandinavia, this is a realization, sort of like a social realization that, wait a minute, maybe we should find a better way to deal with this stuff than just like keep killing each other. This is also something that the church started promoting in the 1100s. So there's a bunch of like folk tales and folk songs and ballads and so on from the medieval period, from Scandinavia, that talk about this theme too. And the idea of Ragnarok is just one of them, actually, in that sense. So basically, Ragnarok is the image of the world falling apart when people just keep, you know, avenging deaths like that, right? Because but the paradox of avenging death is that the revenge is supposed to point outwards from the family. Somebody kills a person in your family. That's a violation towards your family. So you're supposed to then set the record straight, right? Equalize the relationships between these two families by killing one from their family. Now, if somebody from your family kills somebody from your family, then you're fucked, because you can only start killing within the family. Brother avenging brother, avenging brother, avenging brother, you know. And so that's what Ragnarok seems to be really about when it comes down to it. This the recognition that the fabric of society will fall apart through these avengings over and over. So when that happens, that's a good question. We can place that poem probably roughly in the late 900s, early 1000s. We have a skaldic poet who references at least a part of a stanza from the poem in, I think it's around 1060, 64, down around the time. So the poem must have existed before then. And its themes have been so important in terms of literature that they've influenced so much other literature in Scandinavia from the early medieval period. You know, the Gosforth cross seems to have depictions of scenes from Ragnarok on it, right? That's in your neck of the woods, isn't it, Daniel?
I'm not sure.
Gosforth, isn't that...
It sounds British.
It is. I think it might be Cumbria. I can't remember. But it's like it's somewhere in Northern England.
It certainly sounds like one of our places. Very Downton Abbey.
Gosford. Right? The point is, though, this is a story that's definitely present in the late 900s and the early 1000s. People know the story of Ragnarök, and it's being fashioned in context of also a social issue, a social problem that we need to handle. So Loki and his role there is either naturally inserted or being inserted in this period of time. I think his role is naturally inserted because the image of a brother killing a brother that we have from this old story about Baldur and Hodur and Loki being involved there, right? That's probably being basically inserted into the recognition that we have a social problem that's based off of the feud. That's an issue we need to handle. We need to figure out another way to do that. And then that becomes a springboard for our good friend Snorri to basically write a book that's all about how he hates Loki.
It's like a huge vendetta.
It really seems like it. Like, you know, the guy can do nothing good.
Shane, is there anything else you want to touch on with Loki?
No, I feel like I learned so much.
Good. That's the point. Before we wrap up, Mateus, I don't know whether either of you have watched The Mandalorian yet.
Yes.
I haven't, unfortunately.
If anybody, it's not really a spoiler, but there was something I noticed that seemed like it was taken from Norse mythology. So I wanted to ask you about it, Mateus. So if anyone wants to skip forward like 5 minutes whilst we speak about this, it's not a major thing. So I think it's episode one of season two, they go to kill something called the Krayt Dragon, I think it's called. And it's a dragon that lives in the sand. It's not a dragon, and what we think is more like a Nordic dragon that it doesn't have wings. So it's more like a worm. And it's a huge dragon that lives under the sand. And their aim to kill it is to have it slither over some bombs and the bombs to blow it up from underneath. But also the dragon spits acid, which really made me think of Fafnir and the way that Sigurd kills Fafnir from underneath with the sword. And I'm sure he's got acid in it as well.
Well, the blood will kill him, right? That's what that's what Odin tells him when he's digging the hole to sit in. Like you're gonna die if you only dig one. You should dig multiple ditches here.
Yeah. So that idea just seemed to remind me of that story, but remind me especially of that Nordic mythology type dragon. Of being more of a worm serpent than a flying beast, as you kind of most of us would think of when we saw a dragon.
Yeah, no, it sounds very reminiscent of both Fafnir and also basically the Midgard serpent that also spews, or that is the one that spews poison. That's a standard image involved with the Midgard serpent that spews this poison. That's really interesting. And I would assume that they, of course, because you know what is Star Wars? That is modern mythology. In
Western space, that's what Star Wars is.
Yeah. And yeah, it makes perfect sense that they would take elements from different mythologies and add them to it. I dig it. I think that's cool.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was quite cool. Awesome. Yeah, let's wrap this one up. Shane, yeah, this has been fun. Thank you very much for joining us. Do you want to give a plug to your shows, your podcast?
Yeah, sure. I have a podcast called The Cowboy Boys, where it's me and my friend who's also from Utah, where we grew up doing hill people stuff. And there's nothing of note in there. It's just bad jokes the whole time. And then I have a show called Without a Country, which is a political talk show. So if you want to hear a guy who didn't graduate high school talk about political science, that's for you.
They're the people I trust to talk about politics.
There you go. and then yeah, that's it. I'm Shadozer online. You can find me if you want, but that's it.
Perfect. Awesome. Mateus, what about you? Where can people find you? I know some people were asking about the paper you mentioned about masculinity. I don't know if you can let people know where they can find that.
So you can find that paper in a obscure Polish publication. So if you go to my Instagram, which is just my name, Matthias Nordvik, that's how you find me there. There will be a picture that gives you the nice little front of that publication that has my article and also the list of content, I believe. And yeah, so... So that's how you can find that. Usually I make sure to notify people that I've published something new on my Instagram. So yeah, go there and find me and figure it out.
Awesome. Yes, everyone, you can find me at Daniel Farrand 1 on Instagram. Obviously, you've got Nord Mythology Podcast on Instagram. You've got same on Facebook, our website, nordmythologypodcast.com. You can get merch from there. The first batch have been shipped out. We're going to ship another batch out tomorrow. Mateus, yours is on your way. Obviously, if you like what we do, you can support us on Patreon. Once we get to 100 followers, we'll do another weekly show where we sit down and watch the entire series of Vikings week at a time and just discuss, let people know what they think about it, let people know what's true, what's not true, and just have a laugh. I think we're on 90 patrons at the minute, so we've got 10 to go, and then we're gonna get that new weekly show out.
That's good to hear, because I just got back into watching Vikings yesterday, and I was sitting there yelling at the TV all the way through. So if you want to see that live, then
if you want to watch us yell at the TV.
Yeah, I can only imagine I have so little knowledge, and I like the show, but even I'm watching how they fight and what they wear, and I'm like, no, why?
Right? Like who? Like yeah, especially the. Like you're in this like huge battle, and it's all just like you know ridiculous, like waving your swords around and all that stuff.
That's it. When we get there, you're welcome to join us for an episode, Shane.
And, I would absolutely love to.
That would be and fun.
Just take the piss out of whatever you want. But I also I enjoyed the show as well. So I'm not gonna lie, I enjoyed it as an entertainment perspective. So I can't, you know, I'm not going to lie. And I just think it would be fun to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I've always been quite happy with the storyline itself. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They, you know, they've got a lot of mythology to try and mix in there and mm-hmm. make it entertaining as well.
And that's what I think is kind of cool about it, actually.
Not everyone's super nerds like us. Awesome, man. Well, that's the show. Shane, thank you very much. This has been awesome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
No worries. Anytime. You are welcome back anytime.
Awesome. All right. See you guys.